This is Parking in Bitterman Circle number 53 for August 17th, 2020. Hi there, it's Aaron. Welcome to Parking in Bitterman Circle. Today's guest is Mason Wilkinson, who wears the production manager hat as well as others. He's going to tell us about the stuff that happens off the stage that makes the show happen. Due to some bandwidth issues, there are some parts of the interview that are not clear, but every effort to edit the dropouts has been made. Enjoy. So, who are you and where are you from?
God, those are just the basics, isn't it? Man, you're starting simple here. Can't come up with anything harder. That's the best you got. Jeez.
Don't you worry. I've got some paragraphs.
My name is Mason, and Mason Wilkinson, and I came out of a very small town in the suburbs of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Oh, yeah.
60 some odd years ago.
What do you do now pre-pandemic?
Pre-pandemic. Pretty professionally speaking, pretty much the same thing that I was doing when I started in this mess. Often referred to as glorified babysitting, but, you know, chasing the boiling blood of supporting whatever manner I can the production of live music, you know, whether that's tour managing or production managing or backline or merchandise. I like to wear whatever hat keeps me busy, I think is the better way to put it.
Yeah. Definitely know the multi-cap groups nowadays. I know that I've.
Yeah. Well, quite frankly, I think it's sort of a prerequisite for anybody that's going to maintain longevity in this business. Mm-hmm. I'd like to think that having done as many different jobs as I have over the years, that you can't really ask anybody to do a job well if you haven't at least tried to do the job yourself once or twice.
I agree. Did you have an opportunity when you were coming up to study the arts at all? Music, whatever.
I'm assuming you mean in terms of schooling.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I didn't take formal courses in music theory or even production or. I mean, I took guitar lessons when I was a kid. That kind of lit a fuse along the musical lines. I came from a generation when there were still significant arts programs in formal schooling, literally starting in grade school. Yeah. I mean, I remember quite fondly to this day, an afternoon road trip. Gosh, it must have been maybe fourth or fifth grade. That, you know, it's foggy back in those years, but I still to this day remember a road trip where we went downtown Pittsburgh and our whole class, actually several classes, went to what was then called the Stanley Theater and saw a matinee performance of the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra. And I think that experience of and by itself more or less forged that first step or two that I took toward, you know, my deep love and appreciation of live music. You know, then, of course, I made the left turn into rock and roll, but that's another story. But, yeah, that... I definitely had a schooling situation in which I was prodded and poked and almost aimed toward artistic appreciation on several levels. You know, I took painting courses in high school. There were still, I guess you can argue whether or not it's an art, but I remember metal shop and wood shop, and you had to draw, you know, architectural style or very, very focused drawings of what you were going to be building. I mean, that's another art. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, I think all of that, you know, rounded off some hard edges and made me appreciate art, certainly on an intellectual scale.
I keep getting scared of interviewing the younger guys out there and figuring they probably learned how to do what they're doing from playing video games or something, you know.
So yeah, or the Guitar Institute of Technology.
Yeah, there you go.
Or Full Sail.
So, what was your first concert? Who'd you go see? Obviously we have the school trip there, but what rock band did you go see?
The first live show on a, you know, formal scale, but the first real rock show that I attended by buying a ticket myself, you know, that wasn't like some pickup band in somebody's backyard. I don't count those necessarily, but the first real professional show that I went to was Deep Purple with Fleetwood Mac opening up, and Fleetwood Mac at that point didn't have any girls in the band. It was in the Civic Arena, which is also long gone. And that was back when Deep Purple proudly proclaimed themselves to be the loudest band in the world. It was impressive.
Mm-hmm.
Ways than one.
Yeah. Well, I bet, you know, it's been really interesting to ask this question within our community and see kind of who started, you know, when they saw this show or in
terms
of doing production. You just that sort of, I got to do that, that moment there where you get sit there and go, yeah, I could do this. I want to do
this. Yeah. Well, and Oven by itself, I'd go so far as to say, you know, what might have been a candle lit back, you know, in grade school days turned into a rocket. I mean, that just, it opened the floodgates. You know, shortly thereafter, I just started a march through all kinds of, I went to every live show I could possibly get to. Oddly enough, actually, with this whole pandemic thing and all the time at home with our industry being so deadly stagnant as it's been, I've been sitting at my desk and opening up the drawers that we shove everything into over the course of so many years. And I've been pulling out the mementos and the passes and the tickets and taking the time, I think, to share that to some extent with friends of mine, whether it's Facebook or, you know, text a picture of something and remember this one or whatever.
Yeah. When's the last time we paid $450 to go see somebody play a 2-hour show?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I just dug up my Watkins Glen ticket.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Exactly.
Road trip.
Oh, yeah. When I went to, I remember vividly going to Watkins Glen. A buddy of ours had the requisite VW van, the camper van, and there were five of us. And this was back in 73, obviously. And that one last hill that was going up to get to the racetrack was too much for the brakes.
Yeah.
And I remember all four of us pushing the van and getting people that were also in the same, you know, phalanx of people that were helping us push the van up the hill. And we were able to fix the brakes, of course, but it was a kind of an inauspicious entrance. We figured out a place. I can't remember which turn it was on, but we got onto the onto the grounds of the racetrack and camped out like everybody else. It was something else.
Well, you know, and we had one too with those in those years. I mean, trying to explain to people that you had an air cooled vehicle, was pretty special. Yeah, and of course, yeah, I can remember that van breaking down
regularly.
At least once. Yeah. So, what was your first gig? I mean, what, you know, when you started doing, I mean, were you playing when you entered into the industry or?
No, I, as I mentioned, I had guitar lessons when I was a kid, which essentially were a present attached to a classical guitar that my grandfather had given me. This wasn't coming from my parents, but that was, maybe sixth or seventh grade, somewhere in there. And I realized very quickly that if I was going to be a musician, it would involve practicing. And practicing to me seemed like an awful lot of work. So I more or less decided then and there that I wasn't ever going to end up being a professional musician. Needless to say, you know, my attraction to live music and it, in general, and rock and roll in particular, drew me toward it. And first gig, do you mean like literally hired by somebody as a band and on the road kind of a deal? I mean, for years, for a couple of years or so, I actually worked for SIR in LA, and that was a real exposure, if you will, to certain live gigs. And I mean, I don't know if that qualifies for your question, but
no, it's funny because I started doing Cartage in LA in the mid 80s, and within a year I was on the road. So
well, the first road gig I ever had, it was short and sweet, but I got hired for one leg of a Bar K's tour. I did the Bar K's on a West Coast swing, and it was actually kind of tied into that whole SIR thing. Mm-hmm. I did a series of shows that they did on the West Coast only, and they didn't want to keep me. It was when they went to the other side, but it was memorable. It was very memorable. And that, you know, that was the first taste of the road, per se. SIR gave me an opportunity to, I mean, I went out, I did the Jerry Lewis Telethon in Vegas. I mean, it kind of qualifies. You get to stay a couple nights in the Vegas hotel when they were staging the thing. You weren't allied to any one particular act. There wasn't that, you know, band backline guy relationship. It was very much that rental vibe and whatever.
Yeah, but I mean, I remember just coming up through the ranks and doing the award show season and being Jan and Johnny in LA and just seeing
absolutely
them at every single one of those things almost. And, you know, of course, we always had somebody who was coming to play with the orchestra or, you know, sitting in with one of these bands.
Jan and I were both working for SIR at the time. Mm-hmm. They hadn't created or staging it. Jan Parent was an SIR. He was probably the longest tenured driver, delivery, rental tech, you know, whatever you want to call him. He had the best truck. He had, you know. Yeah, we did our share. We had our fun. Plus, you know, that being in that position, it wasn't just the live music stuff. There were really high-end recording gigs that you would take care of. Mm-hmm. I remember some really impressive times, too, going to go to the Tonight Show back when Johnny Carson was still there. Mm-hmm. And that was impressive. I mean, I did my share with Leno, but when Johnny was still there, that was another time. That was definitely another deal for sure.
It's so, yeah. But I mean, when you've got people like that, there's just a vibe, you know. You just it doesn't, you know, you come to some of those shows now and it's just like, you know, it's like what Letterman said, it's high school with money.
Yeah.
So, you know,
I think also back in that time frame, you know, when Johnny was part of that deal and whatever, there was a different attitude toward the business. You know, mm-hmm. there was a respect maybe and a approach, professionally speaking, that you don't see these days. No. You don't see it. And quite frankly, I don't think you hear it either. I think, you know, today's music is extremely disposable.
Well, you know, I mean, there's always been pop music, you know, but there was a time there, just that zone, the 70s and into the mid 80s, where you actually had people who were doing both, selling records and making real music.
Absolutely.
So would you say that you had a mentor at any point?
You mean for Roadster?
Yeah.
In general, or?
Yeah.
Well, Jan was instrumental in kind of showing me the ropes of what it meant to be in that particular position, which Oven by itself wasn't everything. At another point, I ended up getting hired by, I worked for Show Lights for a while. I was a lighting tech, and I did Show Lights for a couple of years. And that was right about the time they moved from Texas to the West Coast. And that was a big change in terms of that company. And I got exposed to a whole lot of road guys doing gigs with them. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, I actually built the lighting rig, because Show Lights had the contract to do the US Festival lighting rig. And I went out there and built that, and they were going to send us home because all the LDs and all the bands that went to the US Festival, you know, they only needed a couple of guys to run dimmers and whatever. And I wasn't that far up the totem pole, but I had done a bunch of Cartage stuff and made some friends along the line on SIR and kind of learned a few tricks and of the trade from a bunch of the Eagles guys, because they were doing so much. You know, there was that live Eagles record, for instance, at the Santa Monica Civic. Mm-hmm. I got to know a bunch of those guys. And after I did the load in and I built a rig out at the US Festival, I was about to get sent home, and I hear my name yelled across the stage, and it was one of the Eagles guys. It was Kenny Graham. And Kenny Graham said, "Hey, what are you doing here? Blah, 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 blah." And I said, "Oh, you know," I explained to him, and he says, "Great, I'm glad you're here." And I said, "Well, hi, goodbye. I, you know, they're sending me home." And he goes, what are you talking about?" And Kenny said, no, I need you to stick around." And he went back to, you know, the production gods that were running the deal, some of whom I think were allied with BGP and all that at the time. Anyway, he pulled some strings and he put me on sort of the basic stage crew, kind of stagehand staff. And that was intense. I mean, I stayed right through to the very end. Kenny was instrumental in holding my hand and showing me stuff. And, you know, he's always been a real steady hand. I did a tour with him when Kenny was the production manager for Tom Petty back. And we were out, and I was handling production with CSN, and we dovetailed. So, I mean, that's one of those relationships that started early and has lasted you know, thankfully to this very day. But yeah, I mean, he's certainly one of them. Bunch of guys. I mean, I met Eric Barrett. You know, we were doing a load in. We did a back when Eric was a tour manager for I think he was either tour production, but he was doing a Bowie tour.
Yeah,
big arena. I mean, stadium tour. And stadium tours were stunning back then. Not like they are today. It was like new ground, broken ground.
Well, it's funny. If I'm not mistaken, I believe George Travis was actually they're the ones that ended up rigging the video wall behind front of house at the US Festival. Which was probably one of the first times that was ever done for further coverage. You know,
sure.
In a
that site was massive. It was just sprawling. I think the whole stage from end to end, once you did the wings, they said it was about a football field by the time they were done building it. I stayed on that crew right till the very end because I didn't have anything else to do, and they kept me on. And I somewhere in my, you know, stacks of old pictures, I've got a picture of me and a couple of the other guys dropping the last bay of scaffolding when we took down that stage. Stayed on the steel crew, and that was amazing.
It looked all of the video I've seen of it looks mighty dusty.
Oh yeah, extremely, extremely. Well, that's where they built that shed too, essentially.
Yeah,
it's out there in San Bernardino. That site became, you know, that San Bernardino shed. Mm-hmm. So, rock and roll has changed the landscape in a lot more ways than one.
It's been really remarkable seeing some of the not protests, I guess they're demonstrations that were happening in the UK with about our industry. It's been
a lot more fervent over there.
Yeah, I'm trying to see if you could get more than 10 people to push a road case over here at once.
Yeah, I think there was something similar in Brazil.
Mm-hmm. It's funny to think of these places and actually having these crews and people of a certain caliber, you know.
Oh yeah.
Where, you know, some of the places we went in the 80s were not ready for prime time.
Nowhere near.
Yeah.
Nowhere near. I'd agree with you there.
Mm-hmm. When I first met you, I don't know. I think you were a backline tech when I first met you. I'm guessing that it had to be doing guitars.
I did my share of that stuff for sure.
Mm-hmm. It's funny. I mean, just because we, you know, as these jobs and performers sort of cycle on, we all end up doing some time with the same people. It's sort of remarkable to me that, I'm glad to see that we've got.
Well, if you're going to have legs in this business, I think we develop, and I'm only speaking for myself and commenting, I guess, on my dear friends that have been around as long, like you and, you know, plenty of other folks that I can mention. But I think what happens is we developed a persona or an attitude, if you will, that seems to mesh with certain types of artists, that you gravitate towards a particular genre or a particular player, type of player that you mesh with. Because I mean, I'm sure you can attest, it isn't just the job, you know. When you get to the level that we're in and have been in, it's not a question of whether or not you can do the job. It's a question, I think, more so of being able to relate to who you're working with and vice versa. It's got to be a reciprocal very personal relationship that, you know, that there's a trust, there's an exchange of intellectual energy, and the artist has to trust you and you have to trust the artist to be able to make that communication so that, first of all, you know what they need to do their job and they know that you're going to understand what they're trying to tell you. I mean, I've worked with enough artists over the years and they're looking for a particular, like, and I'm talking about doing guitar stuff.
Right.
Don't get me wrong. There's some artists that are like that, that do know the gear that well, but there's also plenty of artists out there that they're looking for something to express themselves and they can't, you know, it's like some people aren't car mechanics. They have no idea how a car works, but they know when it works correctly.
No, it's kind of where I was, you know, one of the questions I have is, you know, the difference between musical and technical techs. I mean, people that are, you know, real vibey guys, you got guys who are actually great players, but also know how to keep their musician side in check when they're doing things. And then you've got some of these technical techs. I've talked about this before where, they're not musical at all. They just kind of are fascinated by what they've got, and they're really good at putting things together and having systems work in a certain way. And, you know, it's also one of the goes along with the thing. I mean, when you work with your clients, what you were just starting to say, what do you bring them? Transparency or influence? You know, because you really do have to read the person you're working with, or, you know, God forbid, actually ask them questions and, you know, and get a bit of a thing. I mean, I think of it as like, I see these guys who are more like Sherpas or caddies, you know, kind of helping people when they get into the room and saying, well, this is what this sounds like. This is what you can do for that. Don't bring your monitor up any further than this. You know, I mean,
yeah,
you know, there are people that like that. You know,
the needle swings both ways. I mean, we've all worked with guys that when the heat in the moment is there, it doesn't matter what you told them when everything was calm, cool, and collected during sound check, mm-hmm. you know, and the building was really boomy, or, you know, it was really dry and you had these absolute perfect settings. And obviously we're still talking about guitar stuff at this point, mm-hmm. but when you've got 15 or 20,000 people, or, you know, conversely, you've got a theater that's only got 1700 people and it's, you know, laser focused on you or them, what sounded great when nobody was in the building is nothing like what's happening when, you know, the 4, 5, 6, 10 other people on stage are doing their thing and the 10, 15,000, 1700 people are doing their thing. If you really know your stuff, you've got to be able to juggle all those balls in the air at the same time. You can't just rely on a calm, cool, collected conversation, you know, in a hotel room or on stage when everybody can be real quiet and get the absolute. I remember guys that were working for another artist that insisted the cable between their acoustic guitar and the DI was only going to be a certain length. Because otherwise the sound was going to be absolutely horrendous. And I'm sorry, but I didn't ever buy that argument, because once you get 15,000 people yelling at you, you're not going to hear the cable, you know. And that's what I mean. I think you've got to bring a certain amount of experience, and you got to bring a certain amount of self-confidence. Because if your guy or gal or whoever it is suddenly stares over at you and something's wrong, you've got to stand up and go, oh, I got this. Don't worry. We're going to get to the end of this tune and you're going to finish the show. And I think that's what I meant earlier when I was talking about that personal relationship. It isn't just about the gear. You could know every bias setting on every possible Fender amp, you know, and know exactly what the serial numbers of each year's build was, but it doesn't mean a goddamn thing if you can't tell that the preamp tube is going out, or, you know, they kicked off their reverb pedal or whatever. You've got to be able to look up at them on the stage and go, I got this. And then they have that trust in you.
Right.
And then you get to figure out the knobs or bells or whistles or whatever the hell it is. That's what you're getting paid for, but you're also getting paid to give them the confidence they need to go through a show, because they're not going to figure out those little knobs and bells and whistles. Yeah. That's why they're trusting you. And that gives me a sense of accomplishment when I know an artist is going to give their all and not think twice about whether or not I can make sure that they can do that.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's always been a matter of creating an environment that they feel safe in, and that they don't have to worry about the mundane details. All they have to do is go up there with their song and perform it the best they can.
Ideally. Yeah.
I mean, you just hope you can bring that to them, you know, but we've all had the people who are a dream to work for. We've all had people that are a little more challenging.
Challenging.
Well,
that's one way to put it.
Yeah. I guess I'm a little too diplomatic sometimes, but maybe that's one of my positive shortcomings. Question. I got some questions about production.
About
being a production manager. Like what is like being the boss? Is it kind of like you get to a situation where you can trust your departments, or is it like Fantasia and there's buckets and mops going in every direction? And I mean, we've all seen that before, but
yeah, well, I guess I'm kind of old school that way. And this kind of goes back to what I'd alluded to earlier, where I feel fortunate in that I have been given enough opportunities to do a number of different jobs. So therefore, I kind of know what it takes to get something done. You know, I'm not obviously the world's best video tech. I'm not the best rigger. I'm not the best guitar tech. I'm not the best, you know, carpenter, but I've done a little bit of all those jobs. So I kind of know what it means. And as you get, I think at least my experience has been, as the gigs get bigger and you start working with a larger show on a production value wise, you pretty much know what it needs to work correctly. And if you don't, then you shouldn't be stepping into a job as a production manager. At least I don't think you take on something if you don't really understand the scope of what you're doing. And I've often told people, mostly people that aren't in our business, when they ask, well, what do you do? And I'll say, well, you know, I've done lots of stuff. Mostly I've been a production manager the last 20 some odd years. Oh, what's that? And I'll say, the short answer is, whatever's wrong, it's my fault. That's the easiest way to describe it to somebody that doesn't know. But in light of this particular question, I think there's a responsibility, if you are the production manager, to be out there on the floor and be sticking your head in the trucks and be talking to the guys on a regular basis and check in with them during the day. You know, is that, how's your supply line? Have you got enough expendables? You know, you need to be aware and not just wear, you know, a title. And I've kind of taken it upon myself to make sure that I really understood the differences in the different shows that I've been involved with and the different tours and artists. You know, if they add a different component, you know, if they add a scenic element or a video element or something, I want to know the guys that are coming out. And I want to know that they've been trained to run the particular intelligent lighting, or, you know, they know exactly how to solve a problem that might come up, so that I like to look at being able to help make everything work right, not point out what's wrong. I just want to be the guy that can support and run interference. You know, if all hands are on deck and all those mops and buckets are running around some days, because they will, I need to know that I've got the experience that they can trust me to help them get done what needs to get done, or fixed whatever needs to get fixed. I don't want to just stand there and go, hey, that's your department. You know, what, call your boss, call, you know, call the vendor. What's the problem here? You know, no, that's not a production manager. Not my book.
Right.
Not my book. And it goes, I mean, that goes all the way to like the right driver.
Right. Exactly.
You know, you don't want a lead driver that doesn't know how to stage six or seven trucks in the right order. Because then, you know, I'm standing out in the parking lot trying to stage trucks. That's not the production manager's job, you know. And I've been on tours where vendors are going to send out guys that aren't trained and don't know what they're doing. And then the mops and the buckets are coming out, and it's like, wait a minute. You're going home. I'm on the phone. Get me the guy that can do the job that I know needs to be done, because there's 26 or 36 or 50 other guys that need that job to be done the right way. And I can't do them all, but I can see them. I can see them.
Yeah. I mean, it's weird. I mean, I've gone into that situation and had a production manager kind of see that the guy on the floor wasn't doing what he was supposed to be doing. So he just jumped in.
And, absolutely.
And it was like, you know, it was a co-bill kind of situation. So, but I mean, he just did not hesitate. The next thing I know is he was in the back of the truck, you know, and that proved something, but I don't think he really needed to live there, but,
sure. You know,
but yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean,
to this day, I'll still pack a truck if it needs. You know, there's a guy with a stuck motor out on the floor. I'd rather be in the truck making sure that we're out the door whenever they finish that motor.
Exactly.
Doesn't matter to me.
Here, finish this sentence. A road crew travels on its blank.
Catering.
Yes.
Catering. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And I say that whether you're touring with your own catering or whether it's house catering. Because I've done both. You know, I've had the great pleasure and privilege to be able to be on tours that carried their own catering. Although most of them don't these days.
Yeah.
But I tell you, if you don't get good catering, day in, day out, miserable.
I've said this of certain I said, never trust a production manager who doesn't drink coffee.
Yeah. Good coffee.
Thank you. That, now we're going in the right direction here.
Yeah. Bad coffee's bad.
Yeah. What's the most important quality in a backline tech? Now, this is actually from your production side. I'm kind of curious to sort of pick your mind on that.
The most important?
Yep.
Well, that's kind of a loaded question. Because I consider backline techs, I mean, I don't lump them all together, I guess is what I'm trying to say. You know, I think backline has become something, especially these days, that is extremely delineated. You know, I don't think they're interchangeable. You can't just call somebody a backline tech. You've got guitar techs, you've got drum techs, you've got keyboard techs. And it's rare that somebody can be interchangeable in those roles. So I think the most important thing is they understand and can maintain and to some extent service the equipment that's out there. I don't think a guy should call themselves a backline tech if all they do is tune and change a guitar during a show. I think if you're going to be a guitar tech, you need to know amplifiers and you need to know pedals and you need to know how to solder and you need to know how to diagnose what's, I mean, regular, simple, basic stuff. I mean, I'm not saying you need to completely tear down an amp and rebuild it necessarily, but I've seen too many guys that go out and call themselves backline techs and they have no idea once you open up the chassis of something, what the hell's going on, much less where to look for a problem. And that is infuriating to me. It's like, what's the point?
Well, I've sat in that hotel room with that number one guitar lying on the bed with all my tools around it before. So,
oh yeah,
I know that, that little chestnut. This is a thing. What do you have? You have any thoughts about the sort of road life traveling aspect of us that what kind of a person does it take for constant movement like we experience when we're working? I mean, is it normal for a person to spend 16 hours in a town and then be gone? You know, we just sort of, I mean, that's, it can be, I mean, I know there's a lot of people I've actually seen it. You usually spot them when they show up on the bus and just realize they're not anywhere close to being able to handle the kind of discombobulation that occurs when you lose track of where you are, what time it is, and all of
yeah.
All of
the things. Well, it could be any number of issues. I mean,
yeah.
I've known guys that, and gals that have had, I mean, God forbid, substance abuse problems. And, mm-hmm. you know, that becomes an issue. Some people, like you've alluded to, haven't really traveled that much on a consistent basis. You know, they're more, oh, let's go to Hawaii for 2 weeks, you know, and that's what they think traveling is.
Mm-hmm.
I think it takes a certain constitution. You've got to be in shape. You've got to have a mindset that is committed, if you will, to the job and not necessarily, you know, because if you're getting into this business thinking you're going to see the world, yeah, you're kind of going to see the world, but you're going to see a lot more of the inside of buildings. Mm-hmm. And you can make the most of a day off. I mean, I've had guys that I've had to fire because they thought, you know, they could build their sightseeing right up until 10 minutes before bus call.
Right.
And then they missed bus call because they didn't get the bus cross town because they went to go see the Colosseum when they were in Rome. And
right.
Something happened and they got stuck in traffic. I mean, and I'm not calling out anybody in particular, but that's what I mean by the mindset. It's like you have to be committed to the job and realize that you're part of something that isn't a vehicle for you to be exposed to things. You're there to support an effort that is much larger than your own personal interests.
Yeah, but
you can satisfy your personal interests.
Yeah.
And I think that comes from the experience of you know, knowing what you got out there. I mean, I've also known guys that wouldn't leave their hotel room on a day off.
Yeah.
You know, there's a spectrum out there. Like you said, there's plenty of people that are wired a certain way. And it's like, you could be going to the best steakhouse in town and you're not going to get them out of their room.
Right. Exactly. But I mean, I know a lot. I mean, it's funny. I've been repeating these questions with everybody I talk to in one way, shape, or form, because there are such radical differences. I can think of people that I know that I've never seen on a day off, you know, and I can, and a couple of them, like, I, you know, and it's okay. And that's okay. If they've got to recharge their battery or get away from everybody, that's totally understandable.
You know, and some people aren't wired to be around somebody else or a group of other people all the time. Mm-hmm. I think there's that, where they can put their best foot forward with the pressures of the gig and the support of being in a venue surrounded by people that can help do their job.
Right.
And they can be fed and they can finish their job. And then when they get into a hotel, they don't want to see anybody else. You know, mm-hmm. It's too much pressure to try and maintain that happy, smiley face when they're drained. And, mm-hmm. You know, you got to respect that too. I think if you're not flexible and you're not able to understand that everybody's got a different flag to fly, then you might not be the right person to be on the road either.
Yeah. I mean, we've seen that where I've been out with on one tour and I witnessed a guy sort of fire himself and just, you know, didn't, you know, he's already, you know, by the time we knew he was having a problem, he was already in a different town, had already flown himself out of there and was gone.
Sure.
But I mean, one of the things that I think as a production person myself would be the people that I'm working with, I'm hoping that they are big picture type people. You know, it's really easy to get sort of caught up in this sort of coordinated loners, you know, as opposed to a team of some sort where,
sure.
I mean, and not necessarily to say, oh yeah, well, you know, there's that backline guy. He's out getting the rigging boxes off the truck every morning. And, you know, in certain cases, I don't want people going and risking themselves doing something other than their job. But I mean, just being aware.
Absolutely. Well, especially if they don't know what they're doing.
Right.
I mean, I'm all for enthusiasm, but if enthusiasm gets in the way of efficiency and safety, then
I'm with you.
It's time for a discussion.
Yeah. Yeah. I just, it's weird because, you know, you come across, I mean, I've been really fortunate recently to go from a tremendously oversized crew to being the only backline guy on the tour.
Yeah. Right.
So, and in the last 3 or 4 years, I have become so amazingly aware of that the jobs are the same, you know, I mean, you're just adding people to the equation and making it a little bit more complicated, but, you know, some of the things that I achieved with a large organization, I've gotten more back from these smaller groups that I've been working with, because it is a more personal situation, and you're able to do your best and not have to take into consideration dozens of other people. You know, I mean, I'm just saying size-wise, but I mean, but at the same time.
I think that's a natural development of, as you've said already, the scope or the size of a particular tour. Mm-hmm. You know, like I was talking about, you know, you can be in an arena playing the 15, 20,000 seats every night, or you're on a, you know, much smaller 1,700, 2,000 seat theater tour. And those experiences, although they're related, are completely different.
Right.
Completely. And the vibe on a personal level is completely different. I think, you know, the large scale tours by design absolutely necessitate having lots of very dedicated and very specific roles, and definitely need to have that many people involved. You know, you've got artists on a very, very large stage. And if you don't have your own person for each of those artists, there's a lot that can go wrong real fast. Mm-hmm. But if you're in a theater, and like you said, there's one guy taking care of all the backline, the slings and arrows aren't coming that loud and that fast in that theater. And you can figure out how to keep the show going with a lot less people.
Right.
And you know, the magic is almost louder in the theaters than it is on the big stages sometimes, because, you know, they people just don't necessarily see what's going on. You know, the magic that one or two people pull off as opposed to the 22 people that pull off.
Oh, yeah. And then, of course, they start. And then there's always the fun part of having the artists start talking about you while you're out there.
Oh, yeah. A little airtime. A little airtime never hurt. Yeah. Sometimes it's embarrassing, but it never really hurts.
Yeah. Well, I remember one at a time we were doing some sort of a benefit, and we were doing a big crazy changeover at the Meadowlands, and I was out there getting finished, like taping down a pedal board or making sure that something was working. And of course, house lights get called, and one spotlight comes out and hits me dead in the center of the stage. And I'm sitting there looking for the production manager, going, were you going to ask me if I was ready or not? You know, I mean, those moments, they come to you in your nightmares, I think. But, you know, once you've, like I said, once you've lived through your nightmare, you'll be fine.
You leave a time bomb in the LD's bunk.
Indeed. I guess, I mean, we can start heading towards the tail end of this thing. And really the big question and one of the things that we can talk about is this virus and what the hell happened to our industry. I mean, I think a lot of people are pretty clear that they don't want to go out until the all clear has been sounded, but I get the sneaking feeling where it's going to be a very long process.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. Yeah. And I've certainly been either paying attention to or participating in some of the forums and discussions and, you know, outreach that has been occurring on a really wide scale. I mean, even like you've already mentioned that, some of the stuff worldwide. And it's heartening to see on certain levels, but it also shows a pretty harsh light on the fact that we all dearly want to get back to work in any way, shape, or form that we possibly can. Mm-hmm. But public health, on a purely scientific, clinical level, pretty much forbids that right now.
Right. Agreed.
I don't know. I mean, you see the outliers that pop up where, you know, somebody throws a private and all of a sudden some band has now got several thousand people at their show and, you know, they're pariahs. It's like, mm-hmm. How stupid can you get? I mean, I know people that are in bands that went to play at Sturgis and they were scared to death, mm-hmm. scared to death. Yeah. But for whatever reason, management or the band themselves or whoever said, no, we're going to do this. Was that the right idea or the right decision? Who knows? Mm-hmm. But, I mean, and then there was a recent story over in Germany that they were, it was like a, you know, a test almost, not so much for the fact that they were staging a show, but they were going to put 4,000 people in this venue and then contact trace everybody and find out what happened.
Right.
So I think the world as a whole, especially in this regarding looking at this industry of ours, is paying attention to what needs to happen, But the great unknown is the virus itself. I mean, there is so much that still isn't how it's going to affect everybody. You know, I work with artists that the audience skews way up in terms of their age groups. Mm-hmm. And I've worked with the others that are certainly lower. And you can't draw those lines either, you know?
Yeah.
And I think this, all these experiments of, you know, well, we're going to have drive-in like movie theaters and everybody's going to be in their car. Well, you can't hear an audio mix that way. Mm-hmm. Oh, we're going to build like they did in England. We're going to build little platforms, you know, 2 meters apart. Well, I just read that particular venue theoretically could have held 45,000 people and it went down to whatever, 2,500 or something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Fiscally, that's not a model that works.
No.
So I think the medical community has to figure out how to put confidence in a safe response to the general public that they can trust as an audience. You know, I mean, a dear friend of mine insists that, oh, if they don't, even if they come up with a vaccine, I'm not going to take it. Okay. And then if you don't get the vaccine, you're going to just go live your life with everybody else that may or may not have the virus.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. How's that going to work? So that it's a really, really complicated problem that needs to be solved for us to go back to work, at least the way we used to work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I mean, it goes all the way down to the 12 guys or guys and gals on the bus.
Right.
You know, there is no social distancing.
No.
I mean, as soon as somebody gets a cold on tour, everybody on that bus has the cold.
Right.
That's another thing that needs to be solved. You know, and where, I mean, insurance companies,
well, yeah, but they won't play.
The liability issues are off the books. Nobody wants to take responsibility.
Right.
Now, if you hire 12 guys and put them on, or gals and put them on a bus, and then the virus gets passed around, who's going to go after the artist that hired them or the management company that hired them?
Right.
That's what I mean. There are so many details that need to be addressed that simply can't from our end of this. And it has to be, I think, a very, very coordinated effort between people that make decisions in management and artistically and whatever, based solely on scientific proof that the virus can be dealt with. You know, God knows there's enough people that want to go back to work. You know, either the artists or the support staff or, you know, the vendors or the popcorn sellers or the, you know, the parking lot people, whoever.
Yeah, everybody. It's one of those things. I mean, I agree. I think that the vaccine issue is going to be big. I mean, if they can narrow this one down before it turns into something else.
And I think it's a matter of having to see actual proof of efficacy.
Mm-hmm.
It even works. I mean, because even the flu shots, they're only, what, 50, 60% effective for
right.
a regular flu shot?
Yeah.
So, and virus kills or certainly takes somebody out to the point where they certainly wouldn't be able to do their job.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, right as this was starting, I guess the second week of March, there was some event going on at the Beacon Theater in New York. They had a number of musicians came up to play.
Right.
And six different keyboard players played on the same keyboard setup, and three of them walked away with COVID, and three of them didn't.
Exactly.
So it's just like it's a gift that keeps on giving, I guess. I mean, you know, just.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, the last show I did, before this thing really got ugly was the first week in March. Mm-hmm. And I had a show that had been booked, you know, as everyone else's, months and months ago, before that time. And it was down in Mexico City. And everybody was, okay, are we doing this? Are we doing this? Yeah, we're doing this. And thankfully, it was a big outdoor show, but that was the last thing I did. And that was the first end of the first week in March. And even then, the specter of, am I going to get sick? Am I going to get sick? Am I going to get, you know, it was in one ear. It's like, you got to do the gig. You got to do the gig. You got to do the gig. No, I'm going to get sick. I'm going to get sick. I'm going to get sick. Thankfully, I didn't. And I don't know anybody on our staff that did, band or, you know, crew, but international travel.
Well, like, you know, there's that. And I mean, for everybody else, I mean, it's one of the people I was talking to just referred to the basic exchange of energy that occurs in a concert, you know, with the guys, the energy from the performers goes out to the audience gets a big jolt of energy, and then they throw it back at the band, which gives them more to, and I don't think you can literally separate, you know, this virus from the energy that's going back and forth. It's too, what we do is too visceral. And in most cases, you got people that are, you know, sweating and bumping uglies out there in the audience, and, you know,
absolutely.
You know, so something's got to give, you know. I mean, I'm hoping that, you know, I mean, I was told by management, you know, they basically, once they made their second round of decisions, it was like, we'll see you in March of next year.
Yeah, like, exactly.
And that's a safe thing.
That
for
looks
them.
A little iffy.
Yeah, it's safe for them to say, and it kind of gives us a time frame. But because I've been honestly wondering, what in the holy hell would I do down here in Dallas to, you know, keep the wolves at bay? You know, because I don't know what I mean.
Well, exactly, and we're not getting the kind of support. I mean, again, this goes back. You know, everybody's whining and moaning about the government not doing their job. And
yeah,
they're probably not doing their job the worst in terms of supporting our industry.
Yeah.
But they bailed out the auto industry. They bailed out the banks. They bailed out whoever.
Yeah.
When things got really tough. But you start adding it up. And I don't know the actual numbers myself. I'm not the accountant, but there's literally millions of people that work in the entertainment business, whether it's rock and roll, country, classical, you know, the Broadway. Mm-hmm. You start adding up all those people and the ticket takers and the parking lot attendants and the popcorn sellers and, you know, the crew guys and the union guys and the stagehands and the agents. I mean,
yeah,
look what happened to CAA?
It's crazy. Yeah.
Right. So you add up all those people, we're literally talking millions of people and billions of dollars of revenue when you put all those factors together. And why isn't there anything being done financially to support the entertainment business?
I mean,
okay, we're rock and rollers, or we're music people, but there is a way, I think, that the government could funnel money, particularly into our business, entertainment business, if you will, that is just as specific as, you know, hospitality. You know, why are we spending tons of money supporting the private clubs and the hotels and the resorts and the cruise ships in terms of bailout dough, but we're not going that extra couple steps into our world.
Right.
That I don't understand, because I think the numbers are even bigger, quite frankly.
I think once everybody is binged out on Netflix and there's nothing in the can anymore that they can watch, I think that's when we're going to finally get some people going. So, what are we going to have to do to make this change? You know,
and yeah, really.
But, I'll tell you, it's a question for the ages. I have a feeling this thing, but
the question hasn't had to be asked.
No,
a long, long time.
Yeah. Well, we were always safe. If the economy was bad, we did great. The economy was good, we did great.
Yeah, exactly. People still want to go out and see something.
Yeah, they want to escape for a while. And the problem is the price is just too damn high this time around. But, you know, it's been wonderful having a chance to chat with you.
Yes, sir.
It's been way too long. And who knows? Who knows what's coming around the bend? But we all got each other's numbers. As soon as it's ready to go, I'm sure everybody's going to be banging the phone good and hard.
Big time.
Thank you, sir. I really appreciate it.
Merci beaucoup. Let me know how to follow through with your checkup on your editing.
Yeah, not a problem. I'll start right now.